couple of housekeeping matters, Your Honor. During the course of Dr. Fagery's testimony, he'll be discussing glaciology and repeat photography series of various glaciers. And we would move at this time into evidence P61, P62, P63, P64, and P65, which are part of the repeat photography series into which the defendants have no objection.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And in addition, we would move into evidence Exhibit P190, which is the curriculum vitae of Dr. Fagery.
No objection.
And in addition, we would move into evidence exhibits, plaintiff's exhibits, P303 and P305, which were the literature cited and relied upon in his expert report and in his rebuttal expert report.
No objection.
All right, so P61, 62, 63, 64, 65, P190, and P303 and 305 are admitted.
And one last housekeeping matter, Your Honor. Dr. Fagery is intending to join family on a vacation immediately following these the next couple days. And so he also issued a portion of the rebuttal report to Dr. Curry, and with within the discretion of the court, we would ask that he testify now instead of coming back next week when Dr. Curry testifies, with the caveat that if Dr. Curry isn't called to testify, then we would stipulate to striking his testimony about rebuttal.
That's fine, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
I don't know if we misheard or there may be a little confusion on those exhibits. I thought I heard counsel say P65, which is not one of the, that looks like Jacobson's report.
Yeah, excuse me, Mark. That's right. I'm sorry, Your Honor. I should have stopped at P64. My handwriting came over to P65. Thanks, Mark.
So 65 is not?
It's withdrawn. Yeah, it's right. A different witness.
Okay.
Right. Would you please state your name for the record?
Yes, Dan Fagery.
Where do you live?
West Glacier, Montana.
How long have you lived in Montana?
32 years.
Have you been asked by plaintiffs to serve as an expert in this case on certain topics?
Yes, I have.
Could you just briefly summarize the topics you've been asked to discuss?
Certainly. I'll be talking about Glacier National Park as a primary focus, along with the glaciers that have melted there. I'll describe a little bit about Glacier National Park's importance, including the plaintiffs, and how it's an ideal place scientifically to be able to tease out some of the nuances of climate change. And, of course, that glacier loss is caused by anthropogenic climate change will be discussed, as well as the feature of glaciers in the park, the impacts of their loss, and that the loss doesn't really need to have occurred.
And in terms of your qualifications to testify on these topics, I'm going to ask you to turn to, since we've admitted your CV into evidence, would you just briefly refer to the PowerPoint slide to summarize for the court your education and experience in your field?
Certainly. I'll be brief, but I received a Bachelor's of Science, Environmental Science, in Prescott College, Prescott, Arizona, in 1975. I went to graduate school where I earned a master's degree from the University of California, Davis. I stayed on for a PhD, which I received in 1981. And then I had a postdoctoral fellowship for several years, also with the University of California. Following that, I was offered a position at Texas A&M University. I was there as a faculty member for about almost 6 years. I was offered a very rare opportunity to be a research scientist in the National Park Service. There's virtually no research scientists. So I willingly took that since I certainly like national parks. I was stationed at Indiana Dunes National Park for a few years before something called the Global Change Research Program of the United States came along, and they were needing climate change research coordinators. So I applied for that and was successful in getting that position at Glacier National Park. And so I moved there in 1991, and I've been working there ever since.
And have you retired recently and moved to emeritus status?
Yes, I did retire in the year 2020. I retained emeritus status for a while. However, I completely decoupled from the United States Geological Survey where I worked. So I'm here as a retired person.
Dr. Fager, in your work as a research scientist on climate change with the Department of Interior and the USGS, did you have a primary area of research?
Yes, my job as a climate change research coordinator was to focus on Glacier National Park as a representative mountain ecosystem and to try to figure out all the ways that climate change affects that. One of those, of course, are the glaciers. So I began a program fairly soon after I arrived there, in which we began looking at the status of the glaciers. There had been some previous work, but it had not been updated recently. And it had not been updated since climate change became an issue. So that was a lot of the focus of that program. And we began by looking at reinstating aerial photography. That allows us to use photogrammetry, which is just a very precise way of measuring what you're seeing on the photographs, and map glaciers. We started a repeat photography program in 1997. We've also employed modern techniques like ice radar and LIDAR. We have done some modeling, and we have done on-ice studies with global positioning systems where we have people on the ground, sometimes linked with satellite imagery. The satellite imagery has provided a very efficient way of looking at glacier area through time. When we first began that program, the satellite imagery was pretty crude, so some of our glaciers looked like a bunch of squares. Through time, the resolution of that has become so good that it's about a half a meter, and you can recognize individual rocks. So that has allowed us to be much more efficient in gathering information about glaciers.
Coming back down to Earth just a little bit, for the benefit of some of those in the audience that may not be familiar with Glacier National Park, using the demonstrative exhibit here, DF5, could you just give us a sense of where Glacier National Park is and where the glaciers in Glacier National Park are?
Certainly. As you can see, it's in northwestern Montana. If you look at the larger panel, you'll see a red line going through Glacier Park, and that is the Continental Divide. And that's very important in the dynamics of glaciers. We've already heard some testimony about snow and ice. And this particular illustration shows the distribution of the glaciers that exist. These are the named glaciers of Glacier National Park, which are the largest ones that are still on the landscape.
Could you explain to us in a little more detail how it was that the glaciers of Glacier National Park became a focus of climate change research for the USGS and the Interior Department?
Certainly. So it was expected that small alpine glaciers would be very sensitive to climate change. They respond on much shorter time frames than, say, a gigantic Alaskan glacier, where a forcing of climate can take years to show up. They're also simple because they don't have internal ice dynamics. And what we mean by that is if you have a lot of stress buildup in one part of a large glacier, it actually can send a surge through the glacier, and the behavior at the end of the glacier is not really tied directly in time to the inputs that occurred earlier. So the beautiful thing about these little glaciers is they just sit there and respond to climate. In fact, we've called them the physical manifestation of climate laying on the landscape. There are a lot of advantages to glaciers because they are up in the rock area where there's basically no biota to respond to. They don't get eaten by anything. And they just sit there and respond to temperature and precipitation. The other advantage is that they are very visible. It's not like you're trying to map soil carbon across the landscape. You can see them, measure them, and importantly, you can photograph them. And humans get a lot of their information through their eyes. And so, as we know, one photo is worth 1,000 words. So this makes them effective communication tools. And finally, the last advantage is that you don't have to explain a lot of physics to people about ice. We all know that when it gets hot, they melt. And so this gives people an immediate intuitive understanding of what's going on when glaciers get smaller.
Dr. Fager, how many years of experience do you have studying the glaciers of Glacier National Park?
32 years.
Have you authored any books and peer-reviewed articles on these topics?
Yes, I've done many. I attended about 40 publications from a larger list that are relevant to this case and this topic.
And have you received any awards in regards to your professional area of study with glaciers?
Yes, a number of those. One of them was in 1999 when I received the Superior Service Award from the Department of Interior. I also received a Regional Director's Award from the National Park Service in 2004, including the National Award as well as the Regional Award. I received some other awards, but in the latter part of my career, I received the Eugene Shoemaker Lifetime Achievement Award for Science Communication.
Dr. Fager, is this the first time you're testifying in court as an expert?
It is.
Are you charging the plaintiffs in this case for your time serving as an expert?
I suspect they don't have the financial resources, and I also feel that this is a topic that needs a broad societal discussion.
Expert reports and in your testimony to
my background and professional experience, education, as you pointed out, and also the scientific literature on these topics and collaboration with a large number of colleagues in the cryospheric sciences, that is the snow and ice sciences. But also a lot of my opinions are, of course, as a scientist, guided by data and evidence.
And as you indicated in the body of your expert reports, they were to a reason, your opinions were stated to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty. Will you agree to use that same standard in offering opinions to the court today?
Yes, I will.
Does your work as a research scientist studying the impacts of climate change on Montana's glaciers involve field work?
Yes, it does. That's how we generate a great deal of the information that we rely on to look at the status and trends in glaciers.
Directing your attention to the demonstrative exhibit, which is DF7, what is that?
So this is an example of repeat photography, which very simply is navigating in a mountain landscape to the exact spot that somebody placed a tripod and a camera up to 100 years ago. And this is non-trivial because they aren't along roads, so they require a pretty large expedition in the backcountry, several days backcountry travel either way. But this is worth it because they offer a really good look at how the landscape is changing, including the shrinkage of the glaciers. And so repeat photography, also sometimes known as re-photography or comparative photography, is a very handy way of showing change.
Who is the intrepid scientist in the photo?
That is me.
Referring you next to the next demonstrative exhibit, which is, oh, actually that one's been admitted, but to this exhibit, do you recognize these photos?
Yes. The one on the right is the one I was shooting in the previous picture of me with a camera. And this is Thunderbird Glacier. As you can see, the historical photograph was taken in 1907. We repeated it in 2007, exactly 100 years later. The important things to show in this photo is that on the left-hand side, the Thunderbird Glacier extends from the top of the ridge lines just below the peak. And all of that white is glacial ice. A particular notice at the very bottom of that photograph on the left side, you can kind of see the ice flowing to the point where it reaches a cliff. It's a little bit hard to see in the historic photo, but that's where the ice was pushed over the cliff. And so the glacier would have been even bigger if it had a landing zone. But all of those patches of ice are connected, and the glacier is a pretty substantial size. Now, on the right-hand side, of course, you can see pretty quickly that it's a very, very different situation. Almost all patches have been separated as they've melted up into the little corners of this cirque basin, or this little high valley, if you want to call it that. But a particular note, if you can see this on the left-hand side, the entire area that was covered in 1907 is now bare of ice. You can actually see some vegetation growing there. And there's a small water pond, which is all that was left of the large amount of ice in 1907. So this is a glacier that is completely and thoroughly no longer functional. If you add up all the little pieces of it, it doesn't even add up to the amount of area that we typically look at for a single glacier. And of course, this is now broken up into small stagnant ice pieces.
And at least the demonstrative image, Michael, is DF8, is the image we're looking at, DF8. Returning then to a little bit broader perspective, returning to the image of Glacier National Park that we looked at a moment ago, we have developed with you a series of images that would kind of allow other way, yeah, which would allow us to have you explain to us the orient us in terms of the glaciers of Glacier National Park and give us an overview before we dig a little deeper into some of these repeat photography and comparative studies that you've done.
Certainly. So in this photo, you can see the, of course, the entire expanse of Glacier National Park, which is about 1.1 million acres. And you can see light blue sprinklings, basically, of what are now the glaciers left in Glacier National Park. They are sometimes clustered into certain areas that are favorable for getting snow. And we'll talk about the role of snow in building and maintaining glaciers. This is an example of Sperry Glacier in the photograph. The left side shows the names of a number of glaciers, and the size of the font is relative to the size of the glacier. So you'll see that one at the very top, North Swift Current Glacier, is very small based on the font. And Sperry, Harrison, and Pompelli are much larger glaciers. Sperry Glacier in the photo is a classic cirque glacier. We chose this because it is representative of a lot of the other glaciers. It is also one of the largest glaciers that remain.
Before we dig a little deeper into the glaciology, based on your more than 30 years of studying and then living near Glacier National Park, how would you describe Glacier National Park's importance to Montanans?
Well, Glacier National Park is clearly important to Montanans, including a number of the plaintiffs have already discussed their trips to Glacier National Park. Glacier Park, like lots of national parks, are beloved by all Americans as well as Montanans. And in fact, national parks have been called America's best idea. And you can certainly see that that's probably true based on the very large visitation that we get to our national parks. Glacier National Park has had a large surge in visitation just in the last few years. And what people are finding important about that are things like connection to nature. Sometimes it's a very educational experience. There's a lot of family bonding. It's described in family legacies very often. People show pictures of their trip to Glacier Park because they had a good time as a family. Of course, it's important for recreation of various kinds. There are adventures to be had. But I think that one of the things about Glacier National Park is that it's very inspirational. And so this is a time a lot of people are visiting the park. They pause and think about their life. Writers and artists have been inspired to produce products from their times in Glacier National Park. And I think that we see that even some people find kind of a spiritual connection when they're in Glacier National Park. So that importance is very, very clear to people in sort of the aesthetic mode. But more pragmatically, Glacier National Park has some other virtues as well, one of which is it produces water. And we'll talk about mountain water towers. And the snow and ice that are collected in the park feed actually parts of three major rivers on the continent. It's a unique headwaters. And at Triple Divide, you have water going out the Columbia. You have water going out the Missouri. to the Gulf of Mexico, and ultimately to the north, you have water going via the Saskatchewan River to the just about the Arctic Ocean. So you could say in a way that what happens in Glacier National Park happens a long ways away. But it's also a locus for biodiversity. The pike has been mentioned. Glacier Park has great habitat for that. And so there are a lot of plants and animals that do well in Glacier National Park that don't do well other places. Lastly, it's an economic driver of regional economies. And so, as you know, people come to the park and they spend money. Up to 12 million non-residents a year come to Montana and spend up to $5 billion. And Glacier is certainly responsible for part of that.
Historically, what is the cultural significance of the area that we now call Glacier National Park to the indigenous peoples of Montana?
This was the ancestral home for the Blackfeet, the Kootenai, Salish, and the Ponderay tribes.
Is there an emerging field of study referred to as cryoarchaeology?
Yes, one of the interesting things about ice retreating is that we find how much the landscape was used by indigenous peoples as these little patches that are adjacent to the glaciers are melting out. We find bits of history, like little bits of moccasins, plants that actually no longer exist in the current landscape, other things that indicate the changes through time and the human impact on that landscape.
Dr. Figure, you referred a moment ago to briefly to these mountains as watchtowers. Referring next to the illustrative exhibit, which is also in your expert report for identification purposes, is DF-13. Could you explain to us what's meant by describing these mountains as water towers?
Because of technical things like orographic uplift, mountains get a lot of snow, and they get a lot of precipitation as rain as well. But it's the snow and the ice that's important. We actually see that up to 50% of the water that people consume on this planet comes from mountain systems. 85% is a better figure for the largely arid western United States.
And would you say, in your opinion, does that figure of 85% of fresh water for the western United States, does that apply to Montana?
It certainly does, yes. And it varies by small percentages in different places. Some places probably 100%. But that's an average across a number of western states. So basically, as has already been described in this trial, snow collects up there and is held like a reservoir system all winter long, and then is slowly released during the warmer months when we use it for agriculture and rafting and fly fishing and turning on the tap and drinking water. So this is kind of an ecosystem service that the mountains provide. The issue is that this free reservoir system is getting smaller. And this is something to be concerned about because we rely on it quite a bit. An example is that there's a place in India where the glaciers are melting and the government has said, we're not going to build a reservoir here when the ice and snow is gone and the people have to move. So this is a human concern when your reservoir system up in the mountains is starting to shrink. An example of how severe that can be is with Sperry Glacier. Sperry Glacier, we've been monitoring since 2005 for its shrinkage in great detail. And what's happened from 2005 to 2022, last year, is that over 25 feet of water equivalent has melted off Sperry Glacier. And so that's 25 feet distributed over a glacier that's hundreds of acres. And 25 feet is probably up by one of those benches up there. So if you envision that amount of water across the entire glacier that has now disappeared as part of the storage, that's equivalent of 2,420 Olympic-sized swimming pools. We'll never get that back as a reservoir system until things change with temperatures.
Well, let's first ask the question, why is this happening?
This is happening because of anthropogenic change, which is forcing temperatures higher than glaciers can tolerate well.
You briefly mentioned glaciers as being more or less climate on the landscape. So I'd like you to explain that just a little bit more in terms of how do the glaciers of Glacier National Park show a changing climate?
Primarily by melting. So I think that we can look at the size and volume of glaciers in response to different amounts of temperature increases. And the projections are fairly dire because the temperatures are going up. And as was pointed out by a previous expert witness, they're going up more quickly. And the ice responds very quickly to that. The small glaciers respond within a few years, unlike larger glaciers in Alaska.
Referring next to the next image that you just briefly discussed a moment ago, what is that?
This is Grinnell Glacier, taken from the summit of Mount Gould. And this is a series of photographs that were as precisely repeated as possible. The first one in 1938 was taken by a park photographer called T.J. Heilman. And what you see is the entire basin is filled with ice. And the ice actually goes out of the picture to the right. This is only a portion of it. And you'll see that there's also a small glacier just below the summit that kind of is ringed around that summit. That's a piece of ice that shortly before this photo is taken was connected to the bottom part of the glacier. And so this is all known just as Grinnell Glacier. But as melting began, and see by 1981, those two glaciers had separated, and the top one now has the name of Salamander Glacier. But you'll also notice that the ice level has gone down by hundreds of feet. For scale, the waterfall that drains the upper glacier down to the lower glacier is about 300 to 400 feet high. And you see that a meltwater pond began. The glacier has been basically melting into the little bathtub that it's in. And so this lake didn't even exist in 1938. By 1998, you can see that that has increased in size at the expense of the glacier. And by 2009, you see that the glacier has retreated so far that it's almost out of view from this cliff-top photographic position. And what you're seeing in that final image is all the icebergs that have been calving off of Grinnell Glacier, which accelerates melt.
Was that term calving off?
Calving, yes.
Okay. Thanks, Dr. Fager. Referring you next to what we've marked as referring you next to demonstrative exhibit DF 16. What does this show, and how is it useful in terms of describing the processes that you've been talking about?
So this shows the retreat of Sprague Glacier from the red line, which was its furthest extent around 1850. So the mid-19th century was a time when it was formerly quite cold. And at that point, there was gradual temperature warming. And the glacier pulled back from that red line and melted across that entire landscape to, in this particular case, the 2007 limits, the glacier now.
And so to confirm, what technique did you use to do this mapping? What was the methodology and technique used?
So this one is a oblique photo taken from a plane. But what we began doing was taking aerial photographs in 1966, 1998, 2005, and 2015. And we began putting together a time series of the area of all the glaciers in Glacier National Park.
Okay, so you began, after the initial mapping was done, then were they compared each year to develop a chronological sequence?
Yes, they were.
And so this image here is indicates Sperry Glacier moraine, and the red line indicates former margin. First, could you describe in a little bit more detail what a moraine is, and how does that relate to your analysis of the retreat or loss of glaciers in Glacier National Park?
So moraines basically are a pile of rubble that the glacier leaves after it begins to retreat. While it's growing, it's pushing all this rock forward. Glaciers are basically like a slow motion conveyor belt. So they're conveying, rock debris that comes off of the cliffs or little rock slides and so forth. And so, they can sometimes be quite dirty looking if they are containing a lot of debris. So that's all pushed forward by the glacier. But when it stops, that conveyor belt continues producing and depositing all that material, but it's not moving forward anymore. And so most glaciers then, when they retreat, leave a kind of hogback ridge pile of debris that marks the former margin of the glacier. And so these are pretty easy to see from space. And so using that technique, we mapped all of the glaciers that existed around 1850 because we knew that they were leaving these telltale signs on the landscape.
So to confirm, moraines then mark the furthest advance of the glaciers?
Yes.
How many glaciers did you map?
146.
And referring you next to the demonstrative exhibit DF-17, what does this show?
So this shows the named glaciers and all of the 146 glaciers that we were able to find in Glacier National Park. Again, the size of the font indicates the size of the glacier. And some of the fonts are, of course, very, very small, indicating the very tiny size of some of the glaciers that we mapped. This mapping is conservative because it's very likely that some small glaciers formed during that time but we're not around long enough to sculpt them out and gather debris and make a moraine. So we should consider this a conservative number.
If we could turn back to the repeat photography image that we looked at a moment ago, demonstrative exhibit DF-18, could you give us a little more detail on what this image shows.
So this image is taken from the opposite end of Grinnell Glacier. The former image is taken from the summit of Mount Gould there. And so what you see, of course, in the left-hand photograph from 1910 is a large, robust glacier that was Grinnell Glacier back then, coming down from that mountain and actually flowing outside of the frame to the left. You can also see with this perspective Salamander Glacier, which is kind of perched on a ledge in the foreground. If you look, of course, at the right-hand one, you see that almost everything in the former photograph of Grinnell Glacier is gone, except for a small ice that is being sheltered in the shade of Mount Gould. For perspective, that lake is about 187 feet deep. And we have other photographs taken from the shore that shows there's a minimum of 60 feet of ice that was above that current level of the lake. In other words, that part of the glacier was a minimum of 250 feet thick. If you look at the part that's left in the shadows, we used ice radar in 2001 and measured a deep part of the glacier that was 330 feet. And because it was dangerous to get to some parts of the glacier, we think that was probably not the absolute deepest point of that glacier. However, the transect lines that we ran in 2001, you can now walk on. So we had hundreds of feet of ice melt during that period, and the glacier is much smaller.
Did you calculate the amount of loss to the Grinnell Glacier by area?
Yes, we did. And it has declined by 74%. It is currently about 138 acres.
Is that melting due to human-caused climate change?
Yes, it is.
How do you know that?
So first of all, by process of elimination, there hasn't really been any other Earth system event that would heat up the planet this quickly. And so things that would have occurred in the past would have taken hundreds to thousands of years to change. But this change has been so abrupt that we could only look to human causes for changing climate so quickly. Secondly, we look at the climate patterns over the last 7,000 years. And because of a long-term cooling, in the absence of human-induced climate change, these glaciers would not only be stable, they'd be slowly growing.
Is there much scientific debate about that? No. Was this the same technique that you used in determining the loss of volume for other glaciers in Glacier National Park?
Yes, we've used similar techniques across as many glaciers as we could. We don't use the techniques at Sperry Glacier on all glaciers simply because it's very expensive. So we put a lot of our efforts into that single glacier to try to understand it from as many technological points of view as we could.
If I understood correctly, you have mapped a total of 146 glaciers in Glacier National Park that existed approximately 150 years ago.
Yes.
And from that 146 glaciers, one who have existed back then, how many survived?
26.
And what characteristics of those 26 do you use in terms of characterizing them as still, let's say, viable glaciers?
So a glacier is an ice mass that moves under its own weight. And so you have to be pretty big for that to happen. Not to get into too many details, but when the ice is building up, you basically need to get to about 100 feet of ice to be able to have the bottom part of the ice, which is under the pressure of that other 100 feet of ice, to become semi-plastic. And so it is very flexible and begins to move downhill under its own weight. So for that to occur, a rough rule of thumb is 25 acres, 0.1 square kilometers. It doesn't mean every glacier will do that at that point, but it's a way that we can do a survey and say these are most likely moving glaciers. Below that, most glaciers don't have the mass to continue moving, so technically they're not glaciers anymore because they aren't moving, and moving is important because when they do that, they're basically sculpting the mountain landscape. They're grinding, abrading, plucking rock. When they stop, they do none of that. It's also important because the larger size glaciers, the 26 that we refer to, are important hydrologically as well as reservoirs of mountain ice.
Dr. Fagery, in your expert report, you discussed the distinction between the contemporary glaciers and their diminution and retreat, and the retreat of the glaciers and the ice sheets that disappeared from the Montana landscape approximately 11,000 years ago. Could you explain that distinction?
Yes, I think as we saw in the first day's testimony, there are long-term rhythms to the planet. Dr. Renning talked about the Milankovitch cycles, and he showed that big, long-term ice ages occurred on regular levels through time. The last one was about 160,000 years long, and it peaked about 18 to 20,000 years ago, and it changed for reasons that were not human. It was part of these orbital variations and so forth that were previously discussed. And that ended about 11,000 years ago. And in our area, there were no glaciers then for several thousand years. Glaciers didn't begin reforming until about 7,000 years ago. And we have several lines of evidence showing that they began as small glaciers as the climate was cooling, in a long-term trend that continued right up to about 1850. And that ended then with human intervention.
Continuing then to discuss this topic of how glaciers decline, and referring to what we've marked as demonstrative exhibit DF-19, and this starting image comes from your expert disclosure, which we'll then move through the various stages. But could you explain to the court how glaciers decline?
Certainly. So as we mentioned before, glaciers are just a manifestation of climate on the landscape. And the way that occurs is that they are long-term deposition of snow. Snow is what feeds glaciers and nourishes them. And so a long-term accumulation of snow that doesn't melt each season and builds up through the years eventually becomes ice. And we look at all the different kinds of inputs that, and there are some other nuanced processes that are involved.
Could we start with first with the accumulation?
Yeah, so I'm on the accumulation. So what we need to look at is the predominant ones. You can see that that glaciers can accumulate mass with things like blown snow and avalanching and hoarfrost. But many of them only respond primarily to snow. Snow's the big one. And previously, a checking account analogy was used. And in this case, snow is the income for the glacier. And that's one of the primary determinants. And we've heard from other experts about the changes in snow in these mountain landscapes, and it's not good for glaciers. So on the other end of it, instead of accumulating, you start to ablate or melt. And there are other smaller factors that are important for individual glaciers, again, like windblown snow and avalanching. But for most glaciers, it just amounts to temperature. And so the most simple way you can think about it is that glaciers are going bankrupt because they're spending more than they're getting.
And what does this bankruptcy have to do with anthropogenic climate change?
So the part that has changed is the expenses in melt. And so that is how the glaciers are primarily melting. As pointed out, long-term precipitation hasn't really changed that much, but temperatures have changed a lot.
And how have glaciers responded to these increasing temperatures that you referenced?
They've melted.
I'd like to turn your attention next, Dr. Fagri, to the next figure, which was also derived from your expert report, and we've denominated this as DF 20. Could you explain to us what this shows?
Yes, I think this is actually pretty self-explanatory. The blue is the ice that's left. The brown is where we used to have ice. That's the former size of the glaciers. And so you can visually see that all of them have retreated, and the percent of retreat since 1850s is on the right side, and they're pretty substantial numbers, you know, 83%, 79%, so forth and so on. So this is a non-trivial amount of loss.
What about in regards to all of the glaciers of Glacier National Park in terms of the estimated loss?
So by count, about 82% of the glaciers that were there in 1850 are gone. By area, there's been a 70% loss of area of all glaciers. Of course, many of them disappeared entirely. And we see that the rate of glacier loss has accelerated in recent decades. For instance, from 1966 to 2015, we had a 39% loss of the remaining glaciers. These are the ones that have survived. And we looked at 2005 to 2015 for select glaciers, and it was about a 9% loss over 10 years. So that's almost 1% a year. So clearly, if we've been melting at that rate with the original glaciers in 1850, we would have lost them a long time ago. So the first few decades, they were slow to start melting, but now they are accelerating.
And to confirm, Dr. Fagri, in your expert opinion, is this loss of which you speak due to human greenhouse gas emissions?
Yes, it is.
Is the scientific evidence strong on this point?
It is.
A moment ago, you mentioned that except for the heat increase due to human-caused climate greenhouse gas emissions, the glaciers could well be growing instead of diminishing. Could you explain that, if I understood that correctly?
Yes. So later on, there's a graphic that shows this quite clearly. But from 7,000 years ago, when we peaked in heat following the mass glaciation that ended 11,000 years ago, we see a very long-term decline in temperature. And this is not only affecting glaciers, there are changes in plant composition during that same time that show a gradual shift to a cooler climate. But what's interesting is that the ups and downs are all fairly muted. It takes a very long time for the cooling to occur. But when we get to 1850, we start almost a right angle turn upwards, and it almost looks like a straight line. And so that can only be due to human emissions. There's nothing else that would change the climate that quickly.
Dr. Fagery, we've talked quite a bit now about how glaciers in Glacier National Park have receded over the last 100 years. I'd like to turn your attention to the future of those glaciers in Glacier National Park. What does the future hold?
Under our current trajectory of temperature increases, the glaciers will not survive. It's a matter of time. Some are a little more sheltered than others. Whether it's in the next few decades or the end of the century, the important point is that these glaciers have existed for 7,000 years, and they'll be gone in human lifetimes, including those of the plaintiffs.
And what kind of ecosystem consequences are likely to attend that diminishment of those glaciers?
Well, there are a number of them, but one that is often not thought of is that when the snowpack is gone from the mountains, that's when the glaciers start the bulk of their melt, and they're like a safety valve because then they often provide the only water in the headwater areas of Glacier National Park. Of note, over half the watersheds have lost their glaciers and no longer have this little safety valve of a reservoir that melts just when you need it. So sometimes glacial melt is the only surface water. And this is important not only to a lot of plants and animals, but in particular to cold water species that depend on melt water directly from glaciers or snowfields. But in many cases, the snow is gone and the glaciers are it.
Are there any meltwater species that are whose very survival is threatened by the termination of this process?
There are several unique stream macroinvertebrates or stream insects like the meltwater stonefly and the glacier stonefly, and only live immediately downstream from cold water sources like glaciers. They need very cold water to survive.
Dr. Fagery, in your opinion, how will visitation in Glacier National Park be different without the presence of glaciers?
The main thing is that Glacier National Park, of course, evokes the icon glaciers in the park. There is a slight tendency for people to be coming to Glacier National Park to see the glaciers before they're gone. The park will still be a beautiful place, but I think a lot of Americans will find it a little poignant that the namesake glaciers are no longer there.
Dr. Fagery, in your opinion, does the story of human-caused climate impacts to glaciers in Glacier National Park have to end this way?
No, it doesn't. As we previously discussed, they would probably be stable or slightly growing, but for the effects of fossil fuel emissions, intensifying the greenhouse effect, which intensifies temperature increases. And Glacier National Park in Montana not been accepted from those global changes.
What if that regimen of fossil fuel combustion, extraction and combustion was interrupted? What could be expected to happen?
So if we were able to reduce emissions and then with some lifetime temperatures, what we'd find is that the glaciers would slow in their melting and would use and emissions.
I'd like to switch gears now and Dr. Fagery, is there is any of the glacier retreat in Glacier National Park due to natural climate variability?
Not at this point, no. There have been a number of papers showing that 100% of the demise of the glaciers is due to human interference with the climate system. And in one paper that I've cited in my expert witness report, the authors go so far as to say that it's greater than 100%. And what they mean by that is that we would actually have growing glaciers, but for the changes in our atmosphere.
Thank you, Dr. Fagery. So now we'll switch gears and would ask you to, we're going to be addressing your rebuttal to the report of Dr. Judith Curry. At my request, did you review Dr. Judith Curry's expert report and then set forth your analysis and opinions in what we refer to as a rebuttal report?
Yes.
And in that rebuttal report, did you set forth the scientific literature that you relied upon?
Yes.
Okay. And that's been admitted into evidence. But could you just summarize for the court the points that you rebut?
Yes. Well, first of all, as we've already discussed, the melting glaciers of Glacier Park are strong evidence for climate change. They are excellent barometers and sentinels of climate change. And this is backed up by huge literature from across the world, from, you know, many thousands of scientists that have worked on glaciers and cryosphere.
And let's just inventory them, and we'll have a little more detail if after mm-hmm. we just summarize to the court 5 points that we'll be addressing.
Okay. And so obviously the anthropogenic climate change is the source. We'll discuss that. The glaciers will disappear under current likely emission scenarios. An important point is that glaciers are not alone, that we're aligned with glaciers around the world, and that if the desire is to protect glaciers, there's going to be strong action needed.
Dr. Fagery admitted into evidence as Plaintiff's Exhibit 305, and which was Attachment 1 to your rebuttal report. Are these the studies that you considered informing your rebuttal opinions?
Yes.
And are these the types of studies that are useful as a scientist in your field in developing your opinions on climate change impacts to the glaciers of Glacier National Park?
Yes.
Turning then to this first subject, which we've more or less denominated snow drought, do you agree, as Dr. Curry's report states, that the 1930s snow drought is similar to recent snow droughts?
No. The recent snow droughts have a different mechanism. The 1930s drought was one of periodic droughts that occur naturally. The tree-ring studies show that we've had droughts at episodic sort of levels for at least 1,300 years. So this was exacerbated then by a La Nina, and then also by human actions. As we know, this is the Dust Bowl era, and at that time, farmers were using a technique for their fields that wound up losing a lot of moisture. And so, as Dr. Running showed on the first day, hot areas get hotter with climate change. And so this is a kind of miniature example of that, because we had drying over large areas, and that exacerbated the existing drought. Furthermore, dust, when it lands on snow, changes the solar absorption, warms up the snow, and snow melts. So you're losing not only moisture out of the soil, but in areas of the Midwest where it was cold enough to snow, you also were losing the snow early. So that made for a pretty substantial drought. The snow droughts that were discussed more recently have as their origin not a lack of snow, but the snow melting quickly. And as already been described, springtime comes earlier, melting occurs earlier. In our area, any particular patch of ground now has less snow on it by about 3 weeks. So you shorten the snow season, you shorten the amount of water you can have later on when you need it. So if finally the snow drought we just discussed and the 1930s were all the same, we would not have glaciers retreating, because if that was natural variability, the glaciers would recover. But instead, during that period, we've actually had the glaciers driven to much smaller levels.
Dr. Fagey, you mentioned that in the contemporary period that the spring temperatures have increased. Are those increased spring temperatures attributable to climate change?
Yes.
Another topic which you have discussed in your rebuttal report is Dr. Curry's analysis of glacier loss rates. Do you agree with Dr. Curry's approach?
No.
Could you describe to the court why?
Yes. Dr. Curry used the amount of glacier area loss during different time periods and calculated a loss rate per decade because these time periods differed. And so that was a way to get a rate. When she used the time period following the initial melt period, she used the original size of the glaciers to calculate a loss rate. The reason that is not a correct procedure is it's basically calculating a loss rate on glaciers that have already disappeared. And so the more proper approach is to get loss rates within each period using the starting area of the glaciers for that time period.
Directing your attention to the next demonstrative exhibit, which is DF-23, is this your slide that you prepared using the correct approach?
Yes.
And could you explain to the court the correct methodology?
So taking each of these periods, like say from 1850 to 1966, you take the total area loss, you divide it by the decades, and you get a loss rate. The way we calculated it shows the actual loss rate within each of those time periods, and it shows an increasing rate of loss, which is consistent not only with the other data that we have, but it's consistent with global level glacier studies.
Okay, let's see the next one. Okay, thank you. We'll move to that in a minute. Before moving to this next slide, so what's your takeaway from this in terms of the proper calculation of loss rate versus Dr. Curry's approach?
I think our approach more accurately reflects what happens to glaciers on the ground because it's not calculating loss rates from glaciers that no longer exist.
Okay. Turning then to the third point in your rebuttal report, glaciers in Glacier National Park should be thriving today. What did you mean by that?
As described earlier, we see in this particular graphic a increase in temperatures from 10,000 to about 7,000, and then a long and gradual decrease. That's constructed from many different kinds of proxies. The blue area is with tree rings, a 2,000-year reconstruction, but you can see on the far right side the human era, that is when we began producing fossil fuels with our industrialization. And so it looks like the long-term cooling kind of hit a brick wall and shot up. And so when we compress timescales like this, we realize that the planet takes a long time to do things, but humans take a very short time to do it. I would end by saying that if you look at the top of this at the today level, and you use that red dotted line and go over to the top of the green zone, that represents the uncertainty level in reconstructing temperatures from a long time ago. What it means essentially with the 5% and 95% confidence intervals is that we are today 95% confident that our temperatures are much hotter than 7,000 years ago. And that's when the glaciers form. So how can the glaciers survive when we're much hotter than when they formed?
And just for the record, we've been looking at what's been marked for identification purposes as DF-24, which is at page 2 of Dr. Bakery's rebuttal expert report. Dr. You indicated that the scientific literature on glaciers is largely ignored by Dr. Curry. What is the basis to that opinion?
So there's a very large literature on ice melting when it gets hot. And glaciers have been studied around the world for several hundred years in a scientific framework. And in all these cases, the climate changes that have occurred recently have been shown to be melting glaciers in almost all glacierized areas of the world. And this literature was not referenced. There are reports with hundreds of authors. There are lots of, there's even journals that are dedicated to this. And so none of that literature is referenced by Dr. Curry.
And you have collected the scientific. Reputable scientific journals?
Yes, they were.
Dr. Fagery, what will it take to slow the warming and begin to cool the climate to a natural state?
Objection asked and answered. Repetitive.
It is somewhat repetitive. Is he going to tell us something new?
Well, in just in terms of rebutting Dr. Curry's expert report that attributes a lot of this to natural fluctuations, what in your opinion, in contrary to Dr. Curry's opinion, will it take to slow the warming and begin to cool the climate to a more natural state?
Since this is human-induced climate change, we have to take actions to reduce what has already been done, and fossil fuel emissions are a large part of that.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Fagery. No further questions.
Can I go ahead, Dr.?
I'm sorry?
Should I go ahead or are we done?
You can get started.
Good afternoon, sir.
Afternoon.
I don't know if you remember me, but I took your deposition.
I do.
Mark Sturmitz, for the record. Dr. Fagery, let me start by asking about this statement, which is in your report. And you said it today, glaciers will disappear under current likely emissions scenarios. That's your statement, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes.
When you say current likely emission scenarios, what information goes into the mix there? What type of data?
So this references a number of different emissions scenarios and temperature increases going forward and how that will affect not only glaciers around the world, but in several instances includes the glaciers of Glacier National Park.
Was any of that information Montana-specific, you know, standalone evaluation or tallying of Montana's contribution to the problem?
One was.
And do you remember which that was?
Yes, that's Brown et al., and it focuses on Sperry Glacier.
Okay. And maybe I wasn't clear. I'm asking not about the glaciers in Montana. I'm asking about the emission scenarios in Montana.
Okay.
Was there anything Montana specific in the body of evidence that you looked at for emission scenarios?
For Montana specifically, no.
So, am I accurate in saying that your testimony in its entirety focuses on the impacts of climate change and global warming on the glaciers, but not on the source of the emissions beyond that it's greenhouse gases globally?
That's correct.
And maybe just put a finer point on this. Are you aware of any credible scientific evidence or studies that calculate, and this will be somewhat of a hypothetical, say the setting of a oil refinery upwind from Glacier Park, if that could even be done. What that would do by itself to the rate of glacier loss.
I'm not aware of any calculations of that sort.
So is it also fair of me to say that you wouldn't have an opinion on the level of fossil fuel use by the state of Montana that would be reflected in any on-the-ground way at Glacier Park?
I assume you mean that's quantified.
Yes.
Yes. No.
That's all I have, Your Honor.
No further questions. No further questions.
Okay. Right. You are excused. You may sit down.
Thank you.
And making the excuse in fully since he'll be.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you may.